Hey, this episode is really filled with a truly amazing story. From being pulled from your house and sent to a completely different country at the young age of 7, learning that entire culture all over again, to then being pulled back to the United States and learning that culture all over again. Also, being thrown into an overdose-induced coma, nearly dying, and the triumphant story of coming out of that and having the surrender to continue on this journey. So stay tuned. Really, really great episode. So yeah, man, thank you. Thanks so much for coming in. Let's not kick it off with, you know, what we wanted to kind of get into, what we were just talking about, but you were talking a little bit about, you kind of did both programs, NA and AA, in the beginning. Tell me kind of a little bit about that and kind of why you were drawn to one program over the other.
So, yeah, I went into NA originally. It was introduced to me in treatment. I was out in Dayton at a treatment center, and man, I loved what those guys had to say. I liked what they stood for. The NA is completely different in Dayton and in Cincinnati than it is in Columbus.
Okay.
You know, maybe I'm being biased. I don't know. So I came to, I live in Columbus. I came to an NA meeting in Columbus, man. And I'm not going to say that I was completely turned off originally. If I'm being honest, there were just very attractive girls there, and mm-hmm. I liked that vibe. It was a young people sort of vibe.
I hear that a lot. And if it's, you know, even if it's a temporary thing that keeps people coming back, it's unfortunate. But
man, we are on the same page. Support. Yeah. Yeah. I say that. I say that anytime I share my story behind a podium. I always say that. If you're coming here for a handsome roofer, or you're coming here because the cute girl on Facebook sells eyelashes, then do that, man. Because eventually you're going to find the solution. You know, I mean, that's what worked for me.
Right.
But I, you know, it was a bunch of nice looking girls. And that's what kind of kept me coming back. But if I'm being completely honest, I didn't feel like they were my people,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I went into an AA meeting, a couple months after going to NA, and the minute I walked in, the vibe, the people, what they were talking about, their quality of sobriety, mm-hmm. I was instantly attracted. I was like, I belong here. Mm-hmm. This is my home. And I struggled with that because in my eyes, man, I never had an issue with alcohol ever. Didn't like the stuff. Wasn't really my cup of tea. I tried it a few times here and there. But, you know, I was a drug addict through and through.
So. And that's why I always say to people, you know, I keep them away from the differences, you know, because one of the things that, you know, when I went to some AA meetings was, and it's not even the way it's done after that meeting, but somebody had like broken down their clean time, you know, by every possible substance. And I was like, don't give me an opportunity to do that, because I'll always be 900 years sober and one day clean.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, you know, but that's not the case for everybody. So what I always just do is it's 12 steps, no matter what A you go to.
Agreed.
It doesn't really matter.
Yep. Agreed.
Anyway, so.
But yeah, I got there.
You just kind of shifted back to AA.
Yeah, I got there. And honestly, there was a guy that I knew. I'm not going to put his name out there, but I knew we couldn't put any time together. You know, I remember we would go to meetings together. We'd have like 24 hours or mm-hmm. a few days, and then we'd, you know, go back out. And I got there, man. And this guy, you know, he put on some weight. He was glowing. He was smiling, you know, and mm-hmm. I saw him, and I couldn't believe I saw him, and the way he looked, you could just tell an aura about him was completely different. And I got to go up to him and speak to him, and the guy told me he had a year sober. I about shit myself.
Actual year.
Yeah.
More than several days.
Yes. And I was like, this is where I need to be. Mm-hmm. Like, if, you know, the attraction rather than promotion that they talk about, you know, in both programs, really. I was like, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, and this is where I need to be.
So you said you went to, you know, you and this person from time to time would go to meetings and use, how many times did you try working a program, or did you just come to meetings?
Just came to meetings, man.
Did you?
Yeah. I mean, I grabbed a sponsor once, and it was for all the wrong reasons. You know, my son's mom, she's in recovery, and I got this specific sponsor because I knew her sponsor was her husband.
Oh, so she could report back how great you were doing?
Yes. How manipulative we can be. Yes.
Maybe I'll get to see my son more.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. My son.
Blow off the confetti. I just worked a first step.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I tried, I think, one time, but I just wasn't ready.
Right. You know? Did you go to treatment or did you do it on your own?
No, I went to treatment.
Did you?
Yeah.
How many times have you been through treatment?
Just once.
Just one time. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yeah. I talked to somebody recently on here that it was like, I think like 27 times and multiple different states. So that's,
yeah,
I've only been to treatment once.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it for me, man, I, you know, I have to be stopped, you know, I just wasn't ready. You know, I never wanted treatment because I wasn't ready. You know,
I'm just a pussy, so I can't do it unless, you know, if I was locked up, maybe I could do it cold turkey, but not on my own.
I was even locked up, man, and that didn't do anything. I mean, even in prison, I was drinking and getting high. You know, anything that I could find in there.
Anything.
Didn't matter what it was, you know.
So, you moved through the program, and I'm assuming you got a sponsor for the right reason. Did it happen to be the same sponsor?
It did not.
It did?
No.
I was curious if you'd like that sponsor and there was a different reason now why you were meeting up with him.
No, he's a great guy, man. Okay. I mean, we have a great friendship. You know, he's you know, one of my biggest cheerleaders. But no, I had to go with a sponsor that I really felt like I could relate to, and I kind of wanted what he had, and that was just like respect and peace of mind and the way he was with his family and his children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I respect that so much, you know, someone that's a good dad. And I saw that in him. And, you know, I didn't even ask him. He just told me, you know, I'm sponsoring.
He's like, I'll work steps with you.
Yep. He's like, yeah, I'm sponsoring you now. I was like, cool.
I've done that to some people. Yeah. Over the years. I always say I was completely different. I mean, you know, I raised my hand fresh out of treatment and was just kind of like asking people, you know, who's available to sponsor me. You know, 1 through 12, they say that's how it works. So yeah. Who's willing to take me through the steps? So, you know, my sponsor and I have nothing in common. You know, he's relapsed. I got a new one since then. But yeah, it was a totally different experience with that. I just raised my hand and beg somebody to work steps with me.
Sure.
Fortunately, you know, because I would hear, you know, sometimes I'm glad I didn't fall victim to. That's good that you observed and kind of chose yours. But I always tell people not to fall victim to sometimes thinking that you know what you need, you know, like because you'll hear like I needed to see my sponsor walking the walk and talking the talk, like I'm laying in the bushes, like that for me would get me killed. How the fuck would I know what I need?
Sure. Yeah.
22 days clean, you know, so I'm glad, you know, that was a good thing. So did you relapse with that sponsor or did you
work steps and stay clean? So it wasn't, you know, obviously it had nothing to do with the sponsor, you know.
Exactly.
But yes, I did. Honestly.
Yeah, it did. Fuck him. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, so honestly, if I'm being honest, when I first came in, man, all I wanted to do was see if I could get a year sober.
Why's that?
I don't know. You know, everyone was doubting me. Yeah, ego. You know, but so I'm in there. I'm working the steps. I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to. And I start taking credit. You know, I start thinking that, man, I don't need this program as much as I did. You know, I got the great job, the new place, the beautiful girlfriend, the nice car, all this materialistic stuff. And I just kind of took a step back, and man, in such a short time taking that step back, I really thought that I could have a drink, one, and it not completely destroy my life.
So you decided to go back. A lot of people, I find from talking to people and from almost having 10 years clean and sober, is there's a larger amount of people that either go back to weed maintenance program or alcohol. And then there are people like the way I would think that I would do it if I'm going to destroy everything. And that's to do what I did immediately. So you went with the just one.
Yeah.
Just a one drink.
Yeah. Well, no. So I was fortunate though. In that year, I built a really, really solid foundation of friends, people that generally cared about me. I thought I could have a drink. That one drink led to, you know, other substances. Mm-hmm. And before I know it, man, I'm in full blown addiction, you know, back again. Once
again. How fast?
Yeah. Within 2 days.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Literally one drink, popping pills, then heroin. Boom. Just that like quick. In that order.
Because you had already lost all that connection and clarity and
Stop.
And when you said take a step back, so just tell me kind of what you were doing before, and then what stepping back looked like.
Stop talking to a sponsor. Stop going to meetings. The circle that I had and I ran with that were in recovery, I stopped talking to them. You know, I just felt like I didn't need it anymore.
How many meetings were you going to a week before? You started to shave some of those commitments off.
Four.
Okay.
Every week.
And then you said you got a year. You've been through all 12 steps. Did any of that include some type of service work, like sponsoring somebody else?
Yeah. Service position. I had two sponsees. I mean, I was doing what they call the deal, you know, but, you know, once I had that thought in my head that I felt like I didn't want to be a part of this anymore, that I didn't need it. I just kind of told them, hey man, I don't think I'm going to do AA anymore. You know,
who's them? Just everybody?
The two guys I was working with. No, I didn't tell any of my friends. I didn't tell anybody.
Not the people that it would have mattered.
Nope. No, because I knew what they were going to say.
Right.
Good luck, bud. Good luck with that. You know, I hope. And I know my friends, they're really solid. And
they want the best for you.
Yes.
Regardless.
Yes. They're going to say something. I really hope you make it back, man. Mm-hmm. You know, or, you know, quite frankly, you're a fucking dumbass.
Right.
You know?
Right. Because you don't want to, I mean, for me, you try to stay away from qualifying people. But for people like, you know, from what you've explained and friends of mine, you know, that don't need me to qualify them. For me, I'm not the one-time DUI guy. You know, who just got a DUI and now I'm in some class.
Yeah.
So, you made it. You made it back.
Yeah, man. I made it back within a week. Oh, that's never been my story ever.
Right.
You know, typically I'm out for a couple years. You know, mm-hmm. I made it back within a week. And really, it was a phone call that was made to me. A friend of mine called me and he just was like, I think he said something along the lines, man. And this is before he knew I quit AA or I relapsed. He said, man, you're going to save a lot of people's lives, man. You're going to help a lot of people. And I just broke down. I felt so phony at that moment, you know, because my first thought is I want to lie to him and say, well, thank you, man. I really appreciate it. You know,
it makes me feel great.
Yeah. Life's peachy over here. And that's just not the case. I broke down and, I cried. I told him, you know, at that point, no one knew but him. You know, in that year's time, I had built a really great relationship with my kid, and his mom, you know, who's also in the program. And she was the next call I made. You know, I called her and I told her what happened. And I, you know, cause I didn't want her to feel like I was lying to her. Mm-hmm. And,
or she was the last person to know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, cause
especially if your kid went over there,
yeah,
that would have been a totally different story.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man, it was hard coming back, if I'm being honest, you know, and it was mostly hard because I made it hard, you know, the program is real simple. You thought
people give a shit more than they actually do.
Yeah. Yep.
No, you're not that important.
No. I had to come to realize that, you know, I really thought, because I was on Facebook and I made a post about my year and I was so excited and I think I got like 173 likes and like, you
know. God, that's me, man. I'm the guy.
Yeah. And no, I'm not going to say no one cared. They were just happy that I was back.
Right.
You know, but I wasn't missed in that that month that I stopped going and relapsed. I wasn't missed. You know, a couple people, you know, felt concerned, but the program will go on with or without me.
I say that all the time. I remember my first secretary position. I would, you know, and this is almost borderline breaking traditions because I would bring like pizza. It was a once a week commitment that I would go to it. And I would analyze it all the time. Like, you know, what am I doing? Is it about this or this? But it's just something I love to do. And I remember feeling that almost like emptiness. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, this program is going to go on whether I, you know, when I had to hand the keys over, you know, I'm like, this person doesn't even, they don't 100% know how to do it. They're not going to bring pizza. Like, this, the whole world's going to end. And that's so the exact opposite. Yeah. It's going to go on with it, with or without you.
Yeah.
So that was your only relapse, was that week?
Yeah.
The rough week. And you've made it since then?
Yeah. Almost.
How much time do you have sober?
Almost 3 years.
Okay. When do you have 3 years?
In about 4 months.
Okay, good.
You know, honestly, sobriety time is irrelevant to me at this point. It really truly is. I didn't come to this conclusion until recently. You know, I had like 2 years sober, and I had drank a lot of coffee that day. I was going to a meeting a lot. When I say a lot, I mean copious amounts of coffee, and I was shaking in the meeting. You know, mm-hmm. I just consumed too much caffeine, mm-hmm. and, I'm leaving the meeting and my hand's shaking. I tell a couple friends, I tell my sponsor, you know, man, that I'm feeling weird, and, you know, and he hits me with the, you know, go pray. And mm-hmm. at this point I wasn't one of those guys that prayed, you know, mm-hmm. I honestly didn't even have a power greater than myself that I understood, you know. I mean, my first higher power was a cute Indian girl,
mm-hmm.
truly. But my only solution was to get something to make me feel better. Right. At the end of the day, I'm an alcoholic through and through. Mm-hmm. I'll forget step one real quick. I'll forget that I'm an alcoholic. My only solution was I know exactly where the dope man is, mm-hmm. and I can make these shakes go away real quick. And I'm sitting at a stop sign. And if I turn right, I'm going home. If I turn left, I'm going to, you know, to cop. And I'm crying, man. I'm bawling. 2 years sober, because I know what's about to happen. I've done this before, mm-hmm. been down this same path. And I'm really thankful that I did turn right instead of left. But, you know, that was something greater than me, because I wanted to turn left. And, you know, like, that emotions pouring over me made me feel like, okay, you know, you can do this. Just turn right, go home, you know, and sleep it off. And I did, and I shared about it in the meeting the next day. And a friend of mine, you know, reached out to me. He had heard me, and he told me, he's like, you're missing a connection with a power greater than yourself. You're missing that connection. And like I said, I'm not a religious person whatsoever. Truly defiant against the whole religion aspect of any program for that matter. And he was like, let me help you, you know, and I had a sponsor at the time. And, you know, he just agreed to work the steps with me so that I can look at it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I had seen him help other guys. That same guy that I was talking about that
right.
a year or so changed it. Completely different person when he started working with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was such a good friend, you know. It was hard, like, you know, but I was desperate. I was truly, truly desperate. And I was like, okay, man, you know, and we got busy, you know, and through that process, I don't know, something happened, man, the way he broke the steps down, you know, and it gave me a little bit of an open mind to take in that, there maybe is a power greater than myself, man, that you know, kept me from making a left instead of a right, or that's kept me sober throughout this whole time. That's got me through these rough patches. Because, man, I was white-knuckling it, you know, that last year. You know, really white-knuckling it, you know. Didn't have any sponsees. Wasn't doing any service work. Just
grinding it.
Just hanging out, you know.
getting it through osmosis.
Yeah.
Well, and the problem is, and you know, I've heard this from old timers. It's true for me. And, you know, I have a lot of people in my support group that 10 plus years is there are these points at like 2 years and 5 years. There's all these little nagging points in any program. I think it, you know, probably with anything, but it just, there's a lot of moments that I think a power greater than myself causes, you know, another layer of surrender. Like it's okay to make mistakes. You know, I'm going to make mistakes. I made tons of mistakes. Shared on previous podcast how toxic I was for a relationship with anybody, you know, certainly not, you know, my daughter's mother, you know, and having you being a parent, you know, stepping away from that relationship because of how toxic I was and the fact that I was going to destroy that, but also stepping away from the fact that there was potentially someone else that was going to be there for her in the mornings, you know, my daughter. So, but yeah, making those little mistakes, regardless of how bad they were, just they're opportunities for growth. You know, they're opportunities for me to surrender more, realize what I want or what I don't want out of recovery or sobriety. So it was probably a really good moment of surrender for you, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Life changing, you know, truly. Because I was stagnant, man. I was just at a standstill, you know. And he gave me hope again.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't expecting that, you know. I'm thankful for him. You know, I roast him on Facebook a lot, but I really am, you know, thankful for that guy because he reached out to me and was like, "Look, man, let's get busy." You know, not saying that my old sponsor didn't have me busy, but we had worked the 12 steps, and I was supposed to be being of service to others, but at the end of the day, man, I'm selfish, you know?
Well, and it's something I noticed with you, even though this is really the first time we've officially met, there are people that are in recovery and sobriety that do other levels of service. I mean, there's, you know, hospitals and institutions, you know, there's opening the meeting, there's secretary, there's the making the coffee, there's giving rides, you know, there are the people there that do none of those things, but they're always there. So they're literally a 12 step in action through silence. Just the fact that they're there. Hey, I know, let's just call him Robert. You know, I see Robert everywhere. But then there are people like you that are attractive to newcomers in terms of having sobriety. And the fact that you can meet up with somebody, the fact that you can be a sponsor, because there are a lot of people that can't do that. I don't think. I know that's the driving goal and it's the heart of the program. But I don't think everybody could sponsor, you know what I mean? But there are other levels of service. So it's a good thing that you made it back and you're able to be of service. Yeah. How many people do you sponsor right now?
7.
Do you? Yeah.
And I'm not taking it on anymore, you know.
Let me tell you a funny story about that really quick. I'm going to cut you off because check this out. This is how the God of my understanding works. So, and I'm in the same boat you are when it comes to that, especially when I got here. But so I think I had like 10 sponsees and a couple years clean. And I remember talking to my sponsor and I said, I think 10's the number. And he was like, "Really?" And I was like, "Yeah." He was like, "Tell me why." And I was like, "I don't know. It just seems manageable. And where everybody's at right now, I just think 10's a good number for me, I think." And he was like, "You know, how do you know what it is?" And I was like, "Well, I don't know actually what it is." Anyway, so I remember that night I went to a meeting and I was like to myself, I didn't tell my sponsor or my support group. I said, I'm just not going to share in meetings for a while. Like for like 30 days, I'm just going to not share. And then at the end of the meeting, somebody comes up to me. Some guy still sponsored today. He's got over 6 years clean now. He's like, "Hey, I was wondering if you'd be willing to sponsor me." And the first thing I said to him was, "Can I ask you a question? Why did you come up to me and ask me to sponsor you?" Because I was confused. I didn't say shit in the meeting.
Right.
but I didn't even really put it together or pay attention. I gave someone a year medallion in the meeting. And he was like, you know, I want that. And when I got out to the car, I was just like, that is, this shit is funny.
Sure.
That's funny the way it works. So I don't really, for me, I just, if someone has the willingness and courage to come up to me, you know, but I will let them know what my time frames are. And the good thing is, I'm sure for you, you'll figure it out, is not everybody has the same amount of time or requirements. So they're, you know, and eventually down the road, years down the road, all those people are going to have tons of time and be extremely low maintenance. So the people that you get that are coming in are onesie twosie, you know, brand new people.
Well, most of the guys I work with are straight out of detox. Yeah. So, I mean, there, man, when they ask me, I'm like, yeah, absolutely. No question. Why would I be there and not help them? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm defeating the whole purpose.
Right. Especially if they have the courage to say something.
Yeah. Yeah. But in a meeting, when they ask you, you know, please raise your hand if you're willing to.
You're like, nope. No. Just not for right now.
Yeah. Just for right now. You know, I mean, I struggled with it. You know, my sponsor's like, there's always room for one more. Mm-hmm. Always room for one more. But in the same token, I need to give that guy the quality time that he needs to Absolutely. Work the 12 steps about, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous.
And, yeah.
You know, there was a point where I couldn't. I'm rushing him through the steps, mm-hmm. you know, just to get him, you know, and that's, dude, that's dangerous.
Very.
You know, mm-hmm. so we had
at their pace.
Yeah.
Not yours.
Yeah. You know, like I'm telling them, you got this long to get this done. And you know what I mean? And it shouldn't be like that. That's not the way I was taught. I'm supposed to carry the message the way it was, you know, taught to me.
Absolutely.
So, you know,
the cool thing is years down the road, you'll potentially have many sponsors and multiple different ways to kind of adapt or assimilate to one person that you learn from this person. So
sure. Yeah. And these guys, man, they help me way more than I help them. Truly.
Right.
You know, and I know people say that all the time, and I used to hear people
it's
say
the truth.
It, and I never believed it until I started like actively working with these guys, and they're keeping me accountable. You know, I have, they text me every morning. I don't require that. I'm not one of those guys like, you need to call me every day. Cause when somebody said that to me, I was like, dude, I'm not going to call him every day.
No, my sponsor, I said that to him because you hear that in meetings. Yeah. I said, so now that you're my sponsor, you want me to call you every day? And he said, that sounds fucking horrible. He was like, why don't you just call me when you want to work steps or if something's really going on? I was like, cool, man. Because, you know, me, I'm somebody that if I missed the call that day, I would think about it the next day. And then 2-5 days would turn into 10. Now I'm fucking procrastinating and worrying. Now it's going to be weird.
Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't do that. But some people do. Yeah. You know, I don't get on that. That's just not what I do.
And then, I mean, there's clear-cut direction on the steps, but there is not clear-cut direction when it comes to sponsoring. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has different needs. You know, you just kind of have to know that person. You know, mm-hmm. I have guys that I work with, man, that some have families, some don't have families, some have free time, some don't have free time. So I have to adapt to their situation as well.
Right.
And if I don't have experience in that arena or that area, dude, I'm not going to speak on it. I have no experience. I'm going to, here, man, you know, call Joey or call Tommy, you know, or whoever,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I'm not going to give him information that I don't have a clue about.
Right. So. Tell me a little bit about your childhood. Kind of, how did that go?
Oh man. How long you got?
Go ahead. We've got time.
Well, I'm half Arab. Okay. You know, my dad's Muslim, my mom's Christian. I was brought up in a Christian home until I went overseas when I was 7. Originally, when I went over there, I was only supposed to go over there for the summer, and my dad decided he was going to keep me permanently.
How did you feel about that?
Man, I was not happy about it.
You weren't?
No. I mean, he took me over to Israel, and I ended up spending 4 years there. So, yeah, it was tough, you know. My dad, I didn't know the guy when I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 7 years old, I'm meeting this guy for the first time. No idea who he was.
You didn't have any siblings?
Not with him, no.
Okay.
Him and my mom met right out of college. He was here on a student visa. They got married so that she could help him stay in the country and, you know, get him his green card. And honestly, this is the story.
Isn't that wild, the whole circle of events that allowed you to be here? Yes.
What's crazy is, this is the most messed up part about the whole thing, is his buddy did the same thing with her friend, right? And immigration went in to interview them to see if their marriage was real. They asked her the guy's, you know, cock size. She couldn't answer. You know, they didn't, their stories didn't line up. So they deported him and put her on probation. My dad found out about it, told my mom, and convinced her. He said, we need to know every intimate detail about each other. So they decided to sleep together one time. Once, and here I am, you know, freaking ironic. I mean, they weren't.
Hope his dick was a good size that she could at least report that out.
She could. I'm really thankful for that. So they have me, and you know, they got a divorce because they weren't married for love or anything. She was married to help him, and after he got what he wanted, you know, I love my dad to death today, but he just left. You know, he started a business in Zanesville. I saw him one time when I was two. And then he went back home. He went back to Israel. And, you know, he reached out to my mom. He said, I really miss my son. I'd love to see him. And she was like, okay, I'll let you keep him for the summer.
As a parent, I would not do that shit today. So it was really cool that she did that.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, well, you know, I want him to get to know his dad. And
come on back. You got the green card, buddy.
Like 6,000 miles? Really? Right. You know? I mean, when I went over there.
You didn't speak the language?
Nothing. Well, when I went over there, it was the Virgin Islands. That's where I thought I was going to be for the next 3 months. And we did. We were there for the 3 months. And then he's like, I want to take you home. And I want you to meet your grandfather and your grandmother and your aunts and uncles. And, you know, I'm thinking like.
That point, yeah.
Yeah, like this is a part of the vacation. You know, time. When you're seven, time is irrelevant. You don't really know what months and, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm over in this new country, and man, when I first get there, it was a shell shock. It was a true culture shock.
Why is that?
Well, I'm from the States. I'm from America, man, where we have paved roads. We don't have camels running around, and you know, it's not desert, and it's, you know, there's not fruit markets on every corner, and there's not. It was just different. It's like different. The stuff you see in the movies, you know. And I got over there, and I was like so took back. And my first week there, I watched a lady get stoned to death. You know, so I had experienced a lot of stuff in that 3 years, you know, to become a man, I had to slit a goat's throat open, you know, warm blood spraying all over me at eight, like traumatizing, you know, I mean,
this is after the 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
You were supposed to come back.
Yeah. 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 So the three months.
So he took you to meet the grandparents. And then do you remember kind of him saying, hey, you're good at that moment? Or did it just time just flew by?
Time just flew by. I remember getting calls from my mom. I think she realized what was going on. I remember getting letters once a week from her, and I just remember them stop coming. I remember the letters stop coming, the calls stop coming. What I know today, you know, because I think that was really my first real resentment.
Mm-hmm.
What I know today is she still called. She still sent those letters. I found them. I found those letters many, many, many years later when I went back to see my grandfather when he was sick, when I was like 19. I found him in my dad's closet. But he had me cut ties. You know, with my mom. Honestly, I forgot about that side of my family. I was so engulfed with the culture and the religion of Islam and what my dad was teaching me and, you know, going to school. And, you know, it's a different life over there. It's very slow paced, you know, compared to here. Here it's everyone's in a hurry. Rush, rush, rush. Over there, man, it's, you know, you just kind of like the program one day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And before I know it, man, like I'm like 10 or 11 years old, you know, I don't speak no English at this point. And my dad gets arrested for, suspected funding terrorism. His wife told the Israeli government that he had $100,000 and that he was using that to fund terrorism. And the reality was he did have the 100,000. He had that store in the Virgin Islands. Volcano erupted. FEMA paid him out, and he didn't want to pay any taxes on it. So he went over there. He got the money, strapped it to his waistband, came back in the country, and didn't pay any taxes on it. She wanted a new washer or dryer or something. He said, I'm starting a business with this money. You know, relax, damn, woman.
You couldn't come off a washer and dryer?
He got arrested and spent a year with no charges because he wouldn't buy that woman a washer and dryer. We laugh about it today. We do.
Cheap ass washer and dryer would have kept her quiet.
Yes. Yeah. She called the Israeli government. They came in like you would see in a movie, like SWAT, you know, pepper spray.
But all bullshit, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, they kept him for a year. They realized, man, it was just a scorned wife.
A year.
Yes.
That's another non-United States shit going on there.
Oh, yeah. They don't play around over there. You know, this was before. This was, oh, this was like right before 9/11. You know, but Israel is a, you know, they're a whole different animal. They don't play around when it comes to stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he gets released. And my mom tries to get the Israeli or the American embassy involved in Israel. And there's like, man, there's really nothing we could do. What we suggest is, this is the suggestion they gave her.
She tried to show the her county child support documents.
Well, yeah.
Man, that's not going to work over here.
They were like, look, he's on the birth certificate. He didn't kidnap him. You know, he's his father. You let him leave. There's nothing we can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they suggested trick him. She said, well, what do you mean? He's like, trick him into thinking that you just want him to come visit. So she bought me a round trip ticket and told my dad that.
She pulled the same shit on him.
Exact same shit. Man, they're not alcoholics, but they could be.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot of dishonesty.
And that was it. You know.
So did you have to go through the entire shift a second time at 11 when you got back here?
Yeah, man, I didn't speak no English. I mean, I had no idea what was going on. I touched down in Chicago. I saw my mom. When I came,
she got... where she lives now?
No, she lives in Columbus. That's where just where they were picking me up. When she's got pictures. I'll never post them or show them. But she's got pictures, and I'm wearing a turban on my head, and I've got this dress, like, you know, very traditional. It's very custom and respectable to wear that sort of thing, but not in the States.
She was probably, that was probably a culture shock for her when seeing her son leave like that and come back.
Yeah.
A totally different child.
Yeah. 7-year-old little boy. And then I'm coming back and I'm, you know, almost 11 or 12, you know, and I had no way of communicating with her. She had to put me in a special school for 3 months. And even then I was held back because there was no way for me to progress. You know, it was, nonstop. You know, trying to understand what someone was saying. So it was a rough process, you know, going through that, coming back here.
So tell me about, you know, your thoughts on, you know, religion or God and in any program really, and we can go back and forth on it. My experience and what your experience is.
Sure. Yeah, man, that was like where it really all started. You know, Christianity was how I was raised, you know, and then,
well,
and then Islam,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it was a lot. I was a confused kid when it came to religion. When I got here, I still practiced Islam for almost a year, you know, and then there came a point, I think when I was like 13, I just didn't believe in anything at that point. I was, it was like this big empty hole in me,
mm-hmm.
you know, so confused. You know, I couldn't understand what was like, because my mom is pretty religious, you know, and she's trying to like cram this down my throat.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is very religious, and they're two completely different religions. They believe in two completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like, I was just broken spiritually.
Right.
So...
What am I supposed to do?
Yeah. So I wanted no parts in it. And that's when I became an atheist, mm-hmm. you know, and I carried that with me for a very, very, very long time. No foxhole prayers, none of that. But
that's when I became a Scientologist.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I mean, people would say, you know, and every time I would hear somebody say the word God, man, I just, oh, you could see it in my face that I just wanted to throat punch them, you know, because I didn't want no part of that. And,
So I hear a lot of people say that, and I always, it's just one of those other things that people like us, I'll share for both of us, try to disqualify. And fortunately, you stuck around. But
yeah.
There are a multitude of reasons why people try to disqualify themselves, and that's a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't disqualify yourself. You were just like, I'm not fucking doing it.
I'm just not. I didn't say any of the prayers coming in, like when I'm in a meeting. I did my first year when I didn't stay sober. you know, I just did it because that's what was
expected. Out of respect.
Yeah. And that's what was expected of me. You know, you just say the Serenity Prayer, you just say the Lord's Prayer. That is what is expected. So that's what I'm going to do. I was willing to do anything. You know, I knew that I didn't want to die.
Right.
Before I got sober that year, when in that year, I had overdosed, man, and it was bad. Mm. Like, I was scared. I just knew I didn't want to die, you know? So that's why I went to treatment, you know? And when I came in, I'm like, dude, I'll do whatever. Like, what? And this sponsor that I had was very religious. I mean, when I say, like, he
your
was
your first sponsor, the yeah. one that you got for your son's mom.
No, not this.
This the first?
Yes, yeah. Not the one with my son's mom.
Okay.
The one right after that, when I really took the program serious.
Got you.
Yeah. And he's a very, very religious guy. And like I said, man, he had a great family life. He had everything I wanted, except for that part. I didn't want no part of that, but it was suggested, you know, do this. And man, I just felt, if I'm being honest, I felt phony. Felt like I was lying. I just felt disgusting inside, like I was lying to myself and I'm lying to these people. And how am I supposed to recover if I'm always lying,
mm-hmm.
you know, saying that I believe in something that I don't believe in.
Like something that you left off of a 4-step or never made amends for in a 9th.
Yes.
It's still there.
Yes. You know, and I'm not going to say that was the reason I picked up, but it definitely haven't carrying around that anger and being a liar, just being a sober liar is... Man, that's another level, you know.
Quite honestly, thinking that you're the solution for defects.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's nuts, man. It is. Yeah.
If you think about it that way.
Yeah.
You're the, you know, pride and ego is the main, I think, agitator of all sure. defects, but that you're also the solution.
Yeah. It's nuts, but yeah. Like, that's where I was at. And, obviously, I didn't, you know, stay sober. But when I came back in that week, man, I knew I needed a different sponsor. And I remember asking this guy, and I
still
knew,
don't agree with that, but I get what you say.
Yeah, you what about needed. Needing? And yeah. Well, this is how
you're guided to something different.
I felt like I needed someone that I can be really honest with.
Yeah.
That I don't have a God in my understanding.
Did you feel like that you didn't want to let that person down?
Yes.
Is that
oh,
why?
I held him up on a pedestal. Absolutely. And I think that is another stigma that comes along with any program. Like
right.
your sponsor is, you know, at this level and you're at this level, you know, at a certain level. You're not. It is that. And I tell any guys that I work with, bro, I am one bad decision from being right where you're at. If anything, you have better quality sobriety than me because you want it more. Right, you're chasing it more, you know. And that's how I am with my sponsor today. You know, that's how I am with the guys that I work with. I don't even like to call them sponsees. There's so much ego behind it. You know?
You're so unique.
I just say guys that I work with.
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? No right. one needs, I don't know. I don't even do coins. Like, I just don't. Like, if they get a year and they ask me, you know, can you? Then sure, because we can do that to show.
I make it a big deal for them.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Because my sponsor made it a big deal for me.
Sure, on your year?
Every year, he would show up and be like,
oh, you know, sure, sure.
Man, this guy, you know,
yeah.
this is the greatest show on earth. If he's sponsoring people, you know.
Attraction rather than
so
promotion.
It wouldn't be, you know.
Sure.
It wasn't anything that I was begging him to do.
But I know that me handing out coins at 3 months and 4 months and like...
Dude, I forgot they do that for those in the NAA.
Yeah.
You don't get those till a year.
Oh.
In NA.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, key tax, don't you guys do like...
Yeah, but just the chairperson you don't know just hands those out to you. Here you go.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm like, dude, I used to love to do it. And you know, like recently I'm like, dude, it's all ego. Look at me type of ordeal. So I didn't want any part of that. But I think that, you know, that stigma is in both programs. You know, your sponsor is on this level and you're right below him because he's helping you through the 12 steps. Dude, it's a bunch of horse shit.
The suggestion I would make is maybe ask them what they want, you know, because then it's not
Absolutely.
Coming from you. It's coming from them.
Yeah.
If it's that important to them, because there are some people, you know, that I sponsor, it's not a big deal. Then there are some that, you know, I just know it is, you know, so I, you know, I always try to get them really nice coins. It's different ones so that they can, you know, keep them. I always ask that they normally get passed on. I really love the, there's a place you can go to the gravesite, the cemetery, and leave your coin there and take the year that you are. Pretty cool.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it's on Bill's grave, maybe.
Really?
Yeah, you, there's just a shitload of medallions, and you go up there and you drop yours off so that someone in the world, United States, or in that state, and you take the one that you have if you need it.
Man, that's cool.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's a really cool shit. So crazy. They mean a lot to me. So it's never coming from ego on my own. It's just trying to celebrate their, you know, their success, because they did it. I didn't.
Yeah.
I was just a vessel.
Well, I mean, that's my issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of the absolutely. Day, that's me. It's all me.
I'm just sharing my experience with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the God thing, let's get back on that.
So, yeah, I mean, it was when I came back, man, I chose a guy that I knew wasn't religious, man. I knew that he didn't, just based off of working with other guys, that he wasn't that hardcore. He was a big book thumper. But he wasn't the religious, you know, like cramming the spirituality down your throat from the beginning. And I needed that. I felt like I needed that because I felt like I could be authentic with him and real. And this is what I was like, look, I'm atheist, man. I was like, I hope that's not going to be a problem. And he's like, I've heard that before. But the only difference was, like, I was like, I think I was just defiant about the idea of mm-hmm. accepting a God of my understanding in my life, you know, because I hadn't worked through that yet, you know?
I think I talked to him, your sponsor, about, we had a discussion about this, I don't know, not too long ago, about as I went into detox, and it was something that someone was throwing around, and you know, what I explained is, in the way I explain it, two different ways, which makes it easy. And it, for me, the reason I share it like this, whenever my first meeting with somebody, because I work 1, 2, and 3 with the people that I work with the first time we sit down, and mm-hmm. then they have a little bit of stuff to do. And the way I do it is I set up an appointment for like 2 weeks on the calendar. So we have to either look at that appointment and cancel it or reschedule it. So, but the one thing I do for the issue with God, I say two things. One is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Like, even if you're borderline, not 100% honest, because I wasn't. I mean, when I first came in, I told people I lived downtown because it sounded better. I lived on fucking High and Welch, you know, but I was a little bit open-minded and willing. Like, I'm going to change. And I tell them, you're going to change whether you want to or not. Or the other way is, you believe that you already have your foundation. Let's say if they were, you know, religious or spiritual. If they're not, I then say, well, do you believe that it's working for me or anybody that you're around? And if they don't believe any of that, and it's in our literature, it's all it says is it's your first opportunity, maybe your first opportunity since you got sober, to practice honesty about what you do or do not believe, and then you move on. And that's it. You don't fucking get hung up on it. It says move forward, because it's, you know, just you're a walking example. It's going to become evident to you throughout the process.
Yeah.
So.
And I tell anybody that, any of the guys that I'm working with, like, look, dude, you know, at some point you might have, the same experience that I have, and you might not. I was like, but really, man, the decision you're making is like, the true decision you're making is, am I going to continue to work the steps?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like you, we do 1, 2, and 3. And when they're making that decision to move forward, you know, that's when I kind of break it down. Like, this is the action part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can talk and, you know, say whatever, right? But until you actually do the pen to paper and you really get into those resentments mm-hmm. and all that fear and that anger and that sadness, you know, that you've carried around for so long, till you really put pen to paper, you know, it's kind of all words. So that's what I tell them. Like, are you, you know, you're making a decision to work the next step.
Yeah.
And then the next, you know, and that's how my, you know, that one sponsor that really gave me some clarity about what a God of my understanding could look like if I was open to the idea. And it seems to be working, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the other program too, because that's, you know, a lot of people will say, what's a third step decision look like? What does that decision look like? In NA literature, it says there's the decision is so as about as varied as it is the members of the inside the program. But the suggestions are stop trying to fix, manage, and control everything. But a lot of times if I'm in conflict or emotions, I can't see that. Now I can, but not 90 days.
Right.
Continue through prayer and meditation to build a relationship with the God of my understanding. And the last one is work the rest of the steps. Like every time I decide to put 4 through 9 and 1 through 3 and 10, 11, and 12 into my daily life, decision-making process, whatever it is, I'm working a step 3. Anytime I'm in my will, I'm not. So right. That's the way I break it down. It's really simple.
I have other guys, man. I just simply say, like, you know, they'll say, what does the third step prayer to mean to you? And I'm just like, don't be a douche. You know when you're being a douchebag, man. Mm-hmm. You're lying, being deceitful, like manipulating and conning to get what you want. That you're being a douche, you know. And yeah. That, it's just that for me, that's how I break it down because I don't know, man.
You're in your will.
Yeah, you know.
It's you.
Yes, like you're being a douchebag, you right. know. The minute that you're of service to others, right, the second that you're doing that, you're in his whoever, you know, you're no longer in your own will because you're trying to help someone, man.
Right.
You're not thinking about yourself. You know, you're trying, even if it's just a conversation or holding the door open for a nice lady or whatever. Any of the guys that I work with, man, I'm like, dude, just do one small act of kindness every day. You know, and if you can do 2 and then 3, and before you know it, dude, it just becomes a natural thing. And before you know it, you're a totally different person than what you were when you first got here. You don't even notice it. Other people will notice it. You're always the last to notice it.
You ever hear that? Do they say that in the meetings? That I wonder if that got around in AA where service work is like pissing on yourself. No. Everybody gets to see it, but you're the only one that truly gets to feel it.
No, I'm going to use that
Do
one.
It.
I have not.
Do it. That's a good one.
Yeah, I like that.
I think I heard that in an AA meeting. A guy named Tony, you know who it is.
Yeah, yep.
He used to come and detox when I back in November of 2011. He was the one that said it. But that's a funny way to, it's
like
a really
that.
Funny way to put it. But yeah. It's true. You know, everybody gets to see it, you know, whether you want it to be ego or pride-filled or not.
Yeah.
But it's something you truly get to feel and receive the growth.
Oh, I like that. I've never heard of that.
So you get through being an Islam Christian child.
Yeah.
And then take me on moving kind of forward, your first like actual conscious time using.
What do you mean?
Using drugs or alcohol. First conscious time that you can remember that you did that.
Oh man, I was like 12. I had a drink. It was Bacardi 151 with Coca-Cola. I had hit a joint and I drank out of a Wendy's cup where it was, I thought it was just Coca-Cola and the Wendy's cup, but it had a bunch of 151. And
whose was it?
My brother's.
Okay.
And it burnt, you know, man, it burnt like crazy, but I kind of liked that feel, you know, and I felt, weed always made me slow, you know, mm-hmm. quiet, but not alcohol, man. It made me excited and like I felt better looking. I felt like I could talk to chicks and like, I don't know. It just gave me this amazing feeling that I had never experienced.
Confidence.
Before. Yeah. You know, and I liked it. I didn't like the taste. I just liked just the effect that it gave me.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried not.
That's how you know you're an alcoholic.
Yes. Yeah.
You see people in the restaurant today when we were just at this restaurant. I was just looking at him like, you know, how awesome is it? You know, the old guy. Whether I don't know for sure, but have like a drink or two and go home.
Yeah.
You know, that's not me.
Nope. Me neither.
Never will be.
Nope. Nope. I mean, maybe modern medicine one day, but not today.
Passages Malibu.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that shit? You don't see that on you don't see that anywhere.
No, I think
was that real? He actually got in trouble?
Dude got in trouble, yeah. Yeah, there was a whole story and article about him.
Didn't find the God of his own understanding, did he?
Apparently not. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's recovery journey is completely different from one another. And I think everyone, if you identify yourself as an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, you know, you are uniquely qualified to help that the next person that's coming in. I think there's a lot of people that go to meetings because it's going to be, you know, not everyone's going to agree with this, but they're lonely, you know, they want to be a part of something, you know, not everyone is, you know, at least the experience I've had, not everyone is an alcoholic of my variety or a drug addict like the other person's variety. Like, they have different, there's different levels to it.
Yeah, there are in this side too, you know. And there are people that are absolutely qualified, but, you know, that becomes everything for them. The community, family, everything.
And what a great program it is, you know, because we...
It's always there.
We're not... You can get kicked out of a meeting, but the great thing about it is the program's still there. There's other meetings. There's other people. There's other fellowship. You know, it's always going to be around.
It's a really cool feeling to know that you and I could drive right now to North Dakota.
Yep.
And, well, maybe not now. Shit's all fucked up. Probably be like, you need to get on the laptop. But 2 years ago, a year ago, you could go to any state, pull up that list, go in, coffee, cigarettes.
Yep.
Everything that you need, a program, the same shit, maybe a little bit different, but same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing.
So even though it doesn't matter, and I never really care to ask anybody, you know, kind of what their drug of choice was, you kind of mentioned it, but, you know, how long did it take from 12 to whatever to get to that point?
By
7 years.
Yeah. It was Xanax. That was really my drug of choice more than anything.
Okay.
You know, I liked the effects alcohol gave me, right? But I did not like drinking. It's gross. Burned my throat. I just didn't like it. And then I found this little blue pill that altered my future. And this little blue pill gave me the same effect, you know, that alcohol gave me.
Without all the danger in terms of alcohol.
Yeah, man. Like, I didn't have to drink that nasty shit anymore, man. I just popped this little blue pill and I was off to the races.
I shouldn't say no danger. The reason I said that, for anyone that's listening, for me personally, I'm extremely dangerous. Like, violent. I'm not the happy guy. I'm not the guy that, you know, laughs and everybody, you know, pisses on himself and goes home. Like, I never fall down. I never whatever. I'm up, blacked out, and dangerous. So that's what I meant. They're all dangerous. I just wanted to
clarify.
For me, in my head, I knew what I was saying, but maybe somebody didn't understand.
Sure. Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. I found this blue pill, man, and it changed my life, you know, and I was off to the races. And there, you know, there's gaps of years that I just don't remember. Other people remember. Yeah, man. Like, I hear stories all the time, you know, family reunions.
It's a weird gut feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They're like, you don't remember. No, I don't remember that. And they're like, oh, you were so embarrassing. Yeah, you made a complete fool of yourself. And I was like, I'm glad I don't remember that, you know. Right. And it took me to places I never thought I would go. My first time trying to get sober was when I was like 20 and I went back overseas. I knew they didn't have drugs or alcohol there. You know,
but you tried to detox off of Xanax?
Mm-hmm. It was an Islamic state. I knew that they did not have alcohol or drugs there. I couldn't find it.
But did you realize that you could have died?
I did not know. I did not know that, you know, that Xanax could kill you if you just completely detox off of it.
Yeah.
It's just like alcohol. I didn't know that at the time. You know, I didn't even know that I was a drug addict. I thought I had a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, man, I might have a problem. It's getting bad.
Well, what a lot of people don't say in any program is drugs are really fucking good.
Yeah. Yes.
At the end of the day.
I didn't do the drugs just because.
Sometimes I, like you feel about some things, the person that stands up there and says that, you know, it was absolutely horrible the whole time. That's bullshit.
Yeah. I don't.
That's 100% bullshit.
Yeah. I don't share that. I always shit. Because it's the truth, man. Like, why else would I continue to do them? Right. You know, it wasn't all miserable. And I had fun between 13 to 19. I really did.
Yeah.
And house parties. I met a lot of great people. You know, their lives went on, and you know that some are lawyers and doctors, and you know, I even know one of the guys. He's sitting on city council. You know, that I grew up with. So that all of that is just means that they're not like me. Mm-hmm. You know, they can pick it up and not ever touch it again. You know, I'm just not that. That's not the case for me. When I hit 19, almost 20, I realized, dude, I might have a problem. You know, I can't stop. Everyone else is going to college, and I'm here like running in circles and, you know, trying to chase that next one. And
so your solution was to go overseas.
Yeah, I thought.
What was that like?
Man, it was horrible. You know, it was so horrible because it's, you know, again, third world country. This time it wasn't really it wasn't a culture shock or anything because I'd been over there when I was a kid, but I was detoxing and I felt like crap and I felt like I was going to die. And
you probably were very pretty close to it.
Well, here's the interesting part. If this is what qualifies me, okay? It's a Muslim state. I convince a cabbie. I give him $140 American dollars, which is like four times the amount over there, like $700. I convince him to go across the border and go to the duty free at the airport and bring back four bottles of Absolut, knowing full well if he gets caught, he's going to do 10 years in prison. Or if I get caught, I'm going to do 10 years in prison or lose a fucking hand. They don't, dude, they don't mess around over there. There's no law. They don't have a government. You know, they just take you out in the street. I mean, keep in mind, my first time week being there, lady's being stoned to death by her family, you know, because they suspected her of cheating. There was no police. I mean, it was her family just put a sheet over her head, stoning her to death. So I know the consequences of my actions if I get caught, but I didn't care. Mm-hmm. You know, I was so sick and I just wanted to feel better. And the guy gets
That's compulsion, which is always, no matter what it is, food, yep, alcohol, drugs,
yeah,
using, no matter what the results are.
Yeah. Didn't care. Did not care.
So he made it back.
He made it back. He got me my four bottles. You know, I drank like two. And
he couldn't get you anything else.
Mm-mm.
That's the closest he could get.
Oh yeah, man. They don't.
There's nothing over there.
Yeah, he didn't know anybody. Like, you know, it's in Israel.
You didn't have some little West Side guy with a flip phone.
No, he did not. No, man, this dude, and he really didn't even want to do it. If you're anything like me, man, I can convince people to do stuff that they don't want to do.
A salesman.
Yeah. Yeah. So I convinced him and, you know, I preyed on him really because I knew he was poor, you know, and he's a cabbie. They're not making a lot of money. I have all this money, you know, and because my dad, you know, he's a wealthy guy. I knew he would let me detox over there. He brings back the liquor and I'm good for a few weeks. And I don't know, man, I had an epiphany like, dude,
you have to say that again. Four bottles of Absolut. I'm good for a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
2 weeks.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
Most people would have that shit for years.
Oh, dude. I'm
for a couple weeks.
Honestly, man. And I was conserving it because I knew this guy was not going to do it for another month. He was very clear about that.
Yeah.
So I was really trying to conserve it. Just taking a couple shots throughout the day, like trying not to waste. But dude, I had it gone in 2 weeks, and I realized I had an epiphany, man. Like, if I can't get sober here, why am I here? I literally caught a plane almost like 3 days later and just left, came back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up right back where I left off, you know? I was like, if I can't get sober there, I may as well just come back. And, you know, and I took off, you know, and I met this wonderful girl, and I had a son, and I thought that was going to change me, and I shaped up for...
Was this person in recovery at that point, or no?
No?
No. Okay.
No. She had found recovery later on, and actually, she was the first person that attraction rather than promotion. I saw recovery work on her, you know, because she's a hopeless variety just like us, and I saw her life change, and I wanted that, but I just wasn't ready. But the progression of my illness, man, was just next level because... I didn't care who I harmed. I didn't care what happened to me. I didn't care what happened to her. I didn't care what happened to the kid. Looking back, I like to think of that I did. But, you know, working through some honest steps, I realized I didn't give a crap about anybody, man.
Right.
I wanted what I wanted, and I didn't care who I put in harm's way to get it. And
that could possibly be the most difficult thing to explain to someone who's not an addict.
Yes.
is how, that it could, has no it, no bearing on my love for you or anything like that. It's just a autopilot.
Yeah, like can't grasp it. How could you do that to your kid? How could you not? You know, and I'm not a normal. I'm not one of those people. So I don't know how to explain that. You know. So, but I'm not anonymous with my recovery whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Everyone pretty much knows, like, you know, that I work with, or, and that question comes up sometimes. And, you know, all I can really say is, like, I hope that, you know, you or your family members never have to experience that, because it changes you as a person. You are forever altered.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to that point where you don't even have to know you're a drug addict, everyone else around you does.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're just a different person. You know, you're altered forever. And she had found recovery after years and years of, you know, me putting her through just hell, man.
You
know, she found it, and she gave me an opportunity to be a part of it. And she gave me an ultimatum, and I was like, peace. Take the kid. See ya. You know, didn't even look back. You know, I loved him, you know.
Yeah. But it was kind of almost like the same thing that happened with your dad almost.
Yeah.
It's like, see ya, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, dude.
I'm too busy and self-centered, and
yeah,
I want to get high for 3 or 4 hours.
Yep.
Every 4 hours.
Yeah. And I didn't care, man. Mm-hmm. I did not care.
But you saw that, and was that your first decision to try it, or something else brought you to that decision?
No, honestly.
Federal marshals.
No, it wasn't. No. It wasn't the courts. It was, you know, I just wanted to see my kid,
mm-hmm.
you know, it had been like a year, you know, and I didn't know how else to do it. I saw it worked for her, and I'm not, you know, I'm all for Matt, you know, mm-hmm. I tried that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and went in there, and it just didn't work for me. It does work for others. I have guys that I work with, me, and that it works for them. You know, mm-hmm. who am I to judge? You know, whatever gets you, you know, in recovery and not out there doing, you know, fucked up shit that you were doing, I'm all for it, you know? So I tried it, man. And the reality was that I just wasn't ready. I just wanted to see my kid, and I would lie and do all that scumbag stuff that I used to do just to get what I wanted, you know? And that was just to be a part of his life, because I felt guilty, man.
You know,
because my dad wasn't a part of mine, and I vowed when I had a kid that I would never be like him. And dude,
I'm not doing this.
Freaking exactly like him. You know, I mean, so I tried, and I just wasn't ready. You know,
no, and you weren't responsible for it. That's another thing. It's hard to explain to somebody that, you know, in that moment of being in compulsion and self-centeredness and obsession, it's not responsible for those actions for me.
Yeah. Yeah. After some time, man, you know, she did let me see him. And the worst part was, like, I had to see him supervised at McDonald's,
mm-hmm.
and her new boyfriend, who was also in recovery, was bringing my son to see me.
Yeah.
Man.
I'd have probably caught an assault charge.
Dude.
For sure.
Well, dude was way bigger than me.
I was. You're like, fuck that.
Way bigger than me.
Nope.
Yeah. I was like, I hated everything about this dude.
Yeah. Man.
You know what? I'm sick, man. Like, I'm.
But he's there for your son, which is also giving you some resentments.
Yes. So, you know.
That's what I talked about with her. The thought of her waking up in the morning and running to another dad.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry to cut you off.
Soul crushing.
Shit got in my gut just now thinking about that.
Well, because the worst part was, is like when he come see me at McDonald's, he would talk about all the fun stuff he would do with him.
Right.
All of the amazing things he has taught him. Mm-hmm. All this adventures they went on. Man, I hated this guy. I hated everything about him. And, you know, I went to prison shortly after that. And, you know, I wish I could say, like, that was enough, like, that resentment that I had and not being a part of his life was to get me sober. Or I wish I could say prison was enough. It wasn't, you know. What it took, you know, I remember my bottom was when I lost my...
Remember that. When you say bottom, it just really made me think of the lack of clarity for addicts and alcoholics, that you had those resentments, but... at that moment in your life, couldn't even provide those opportunities and then ended up in prison. But as an addict and alcoholic who uses over resentments and shit like that creeps up like that, had the audacity to be to resent the fact that your son was in a good spot.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, sorry I'm about
selfish,
that.
Selfish,
man. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, it's selfish and self-centered to the core. Once I got out of prison, there was one person in my life, man, throughout this whole journey, was my sister. She never cut ties with me. She'd always invite me to family dinners and Christmas and stuff. Like, by this time, I'd burn every bridge, man. Like, my family wanted nothing to do with me. Supervised visits were no longer a thing because I kept showing up high.
Yeah.
But she was the only one that never turned her back on me and was, call it enabling or whatever, but I had so much love for her because I felt like the scum of the earth, but yet she still made me feel a part of the family.
Right.
I mean, I'm truly the black sheep. I went to go do some illegal activities. I get a phone call and they tell me that, you know, my sister just died of an overdose. And I thought they said
why you left that part out.
Yeah.
I was thinking the whole time, like, this is a normal sister. She's so sweet.
She was, man. She wasn't one of us. She tried a thing one time.
Jesus.
Lost her life. I remember one time I tried to get her to smoke weed, man, and she freaked out. Freaked out on me. Like, she just wasn't one of us. She could have a sip of wine and you know, leave the glass half full. She just wasn't one of us.
Yeah, that was a curveball. I wasn't expecting that.
She took a pill with a friend, and it was laced with some fentanyl, and it killed her, you know. Took her out, and when I got that call, man, I was so... I thought it was one of my brothers, because I have a brother that's one of us, mm-hmm. as well. And I was just... I couldn't believe it, you know, and... I remember in that 2-week span of when she died and when we buried her, I piled every drug and drink that I could in my body to take away that pain, and nothing was taking away that pain. Nothing. Like, I never experienced that before. I could always doll myself out where I didn't have to feel anything. That wasn't the case with this in this 2-week span. And I finally put so much drugs in my body where I had overdosed, and my heart stopped, mm-hmm. and the EMS, you know, hit me with half a dozen things of Narcan, and nothing was working. And my little brother told me, this is while I'm unconscious. He said that they called it, you know, he's done. So he made the call to my mom, said, hey, you know, Cy just died. You know,
shortly after your sister just died.
2 weeks, you know. And I'm really thankful for that EMS because the other guy was done. You know, they had already revived me 2 or 3 times before that, you know, and I just.
It has such a short half-life.
Yeah, you know, and he didn't. He ended up giving me chest compressions. He ended up cracking 2 ribs in my sternum and then hit me with paddles. And he was able to get some sense of life back in me. I was in a coma for about 18 days on life support. You know, they originally told my mom that, you know, he lost so much brain oxygen to his brain that he's most likely going to be a vegetable. Again, my mom's very religious. She was like, I'm not pulling the plug. We're going to, you know, we're going to pray over him.
This motherfucker's staying on this for 9 years.
She's like, we're going to pray over him. She brought her, you know, church friends in and stuff. And
laughing at your mom just to.
But I mean, I'm thankful for that, man, because maybe some parents may have. You know, they may have, you know, the doctors recommended, they're like, hey, he's not going to have any sort of quality of life, right? She wasn't accepting that. And on the 17th or 18th day, I started showing activity, you know, and they were open to the idea that maybe this is a possibility. And by the time I came to, you know, like my body didn't work, wasn't functioning, but I was lucid,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, I could blink and kind of speak and stuff. And I remember waking up and my son's mom was on the right of me, my mother was on the left, and her little sister, who's in recovery as well, on the foot of my bed. And that feeling that I got was so much fear. I knew that I didn't want to die. I knew, like, this wasn't an ordinary overdose. Something is different. I had this like shaky feeling that I almost died. And before I'd even known anything, I didn't know I'd been in a coma for 20 some days. Mm-hmm. Like, I had no idea. And then, cause the tubes are in my throat, and then they're telling me what just happened. And I can't grasp, you know, I'm thinking it's the next day. I remember my last use, but I don't.
Like just one day's passed, you woke up overnight?
Yeah, you know, no idea. I'm waking up and I got like this stuff strapped to my chest. My arms are strapped, you know, because they're, you know, afraid I'll pull the tubes out. And it was just so bizarre, that feeling, you know, because I felt literally like death, you know, like I was on death's doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so scared. And, you know, I went through physical therapy. And after that, a doctor came in, an addiction specialist came in, and he just looked me straight in the face. And he said, you might have a drug problem, man.
Maybe.
At that,
just a small one.
At that point, I was like, yeah, doc. You know, other people had said that many, many, many times before.
Yeah.
And I always dismissed it. Like, because I never thought of myself as a low-bottom junkie. Like, you know, I was never homeless. I always, you know, had income coming in, you know, I had my own business, you know, like, but he was right. I was the first time I listened with an open mind that, dude, yes, I have a severe problem and I don't know a solution. And he goes, and I was like, literally what I said, I was like, doc, you might be right. What do I do? And he's like, I'm glad that you're, you know, you're susceptible to what the next steps are. And he gives me a list of, places, and he says, be proactive, you need to get into a treatment center. And I was like, okay. It was the first time I was like open to rehab, you know. My rehab was going overseas and detoxing over there, you know.
Horrible plan.
Yeah, a lot of good that did me.
At least want to be within a couple blocks of what you need to get. Yeah, once you get so sick.
Yeah, dude. So I found this place called Woodhaven, and I knew that if I was going to do this, I wanted to do this right. You know, I'm that type of person, man. Like, if I'm going to do something, I want to go all out, like, with anything I do. You know, I chose this place specifically because I knew it was long-term, 3 to 6 months. I knew that it was all-male facility, because if it's a female facility, I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to lose sight of why I'm there. It was more anything that was fear that was driving me. I didn't know that I wanted to be sober. Really didn't. I went to this treatment center, and, you know, they helped show a different side of recovery that I never saw before. They helped me take a real good look at myself. And that was where I was introduced to NA. Man. Mm-hmm. And I loved it out there. Man, the vibes. A good
program.
Yeah.
I've had about three people live in the sober house I own that came from there. Solid program.
Mm-hmm. Amazing place, man. I'm an alumni.
There's a guy there now that is getting out in a month, and, you know,
yeah,
sober housing is just full.
Yeah.
Just not typical at this time of year. And the one guy told me it's, you know, it's just, it's always vacant because it's easier to sleep on a park bench when it's warm out.
Yeah.
But there's no vacancies.
Yeah.
That's anywhere amazing. Right now.
That's amazing.
I don't know if it's because of COVID or
right.
People are just afraid what's going to happen, and they're just sticking and they're staying. So,
yeah, that's amazing. You know, you don't hear that often, but I get there, and man, I fall in love with NA there. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're going to outside meetings, I'm meeting new people. The vibe is something that I had never experienced in recovery, and it was like really the first seed that was planted. Like, mm-hmm. treatment was great and all, but I needed a solution that was outside of treatment, because I knew I was going back into the real world real soon.
Yeah, you have to surrender to go to treatment, then you have to surrender to do that program, and it's it's a lot of surrendering.
So you know, I have my own place at this time, and I remember thinking, like, when I'm leaving, my counselor's like, Si, I don't recommend you go back to your own place, man. You know, like, be open to sober living. I'm like, dude, I'm not living with a bunch of fucking dudes. I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember saying to myself, like, dude, you know, I want to do anything to not die. Like, that mm-hmm. was my only goal. I just don't want to die. This is that simple. So I was like, all right, man, like, I'm open to it. And then, like, I want to see some pamphlets, bro. I want to see what these places look like.
Like, you're going to a fucking
resort.
Resort.
He did exactly what you did. He laughed. He's like, dude, you're going to share a bedroom with another dude. You're going to share a shower with like four other dudes. And I was like, this sounds horrible.
Right.
Like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
But I went, man, and I found this amazing
place. I at least make sure there are two refrigerators in there so that there's not fights over that.
Well, this place did not, man. It was, you know, it was exactly what I needed at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, it was transitional. I transitioned from treatment to sober living. I met a bunch of really solid dudes, And, you know, this thing is so cunning and baffling, man. And it like will sneak up on you and grab you. Like, out of all those dudes, only one are sober, you know, like two are dead and the other one's back out there, you know? And it's like, you know, it's the odds are stacked against us, man. You know, it's one day at a time. It truly is, or it's just for today, or however you want to word it. It really, really is. I went to that sober living, man, and I met a bunch of great guys. And I remember, man, it's a funny story. I was the only straight dude there, right? I walked in. I'd been there for 3.5 months. It didn't start out that way. You know, people were getting kicked out or relapsing or whatever. But when I first got there, man, I met, you know, a couple really solid guys, and they got, you know, one had been there for like 6 months. He just got his place. Another one moved in with his girlfriend. So then they moved these new guys in, and I'm the only straight one there. And then what happened was I walked in on one of my roommates giving my other roommate a blowjob, and I was like, I'm done. I'm fucking done.
There's my out. I'm gone.
Yeah, I called my sponsor, and I was like, dude, I know I committed to stay here 6 months, but I'm done, dude. And I told him what happened, and he's like, this is not your will. Like, you're running on your own will. And I was like, fuck you. And
here's my out.
Yes.
My different opinion on things. Yep. I'm fucking out.
Yeah. That's exactly what I used it for. It was the perfect little manipulation tactic to get out of there. And then I left, man, and I got my own place. And, you know, I'm still at that same place. But what I did, I will say this, man, I left too early, you know, because I didn't know how to be alone with myself. You know,
that's another layer of surrender. I mean, your man. Treatment, then outside, then sober living, then.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why for me, I don't have all a shitload of rules, you know, where I have the guys. Like 10 o'clock, you have to be in by 10 o'clock. Like who's not going to use if they have to be in by 10?
Right.
It just seems like a stupid fucking rule to me.
Right.
For me.
Yeah. Yeah.
My dealer, I didn't get shit from 10 o'clock. It was more like 12 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't matter the time, dude. Right. Like, if you want to get high, you're going to go get high. Right. You know, I mean, I understand some of them that have that, you know, like, what did my grandmother used to say? Nothing good comes after 10 o'clock, you know, like you have no business be running them streets at 10 o'clock. So, I mean, I understand, you know, each place has their own thing, and this place didn't, you know, I remember we could have women over there, you know, if we wanted, it wasn't that big of a deal. So it wasn't like, you know, hell or prison or anything. I did what I wanted. But I was looking for an excuse to get out of there, you know, and I had it right then and there. And, you know, I'm just a manipulator, and I manipulated my way out of that situation. I got my own place, and I never felt more alone in my life. You know, I contemplated using for months, and it was just the fellowship that kept me sober, you know, or this mindset that I can get a year sober. I can do this, you know.
Yeah, I had that same mindset and treatment because you just said that. I remember, and again, you know, I'll tell you after this, but, you know, somebody that was in doing speaking when I was in treatment, and they literally made a statement about like one or two of you will probably still be here. And that was the hugest chip. And all I literally thought to myself, when I looked around, I said, well, who's the other motherfucker? You know, that's how big the chip was on my shoulder for them saying that to me.
Sure.
It's like a personal. I should just leave now. Fuck it. You know, but anyway.
Yeah, no, man, what a shell shock to hear that. I heard the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's so true. You know, I'm a part of the alumni at Woodhaven, and there's only maybe 4 out of 56 that are still doing the deal. You know, it's the reality, truly. I never felt more alone in that time. And that's when I spent all my time in meetings. Anytime, like, when I got off of work, man, I'm out at a meeting, going to another meeting and another, like, I didn't want to be home until I was ready to sleep.
Yeah, and like, I'm a math person, so I really wanted to have 270 in 90 days instead of 90 in 90.
Yeah.
That was my other goal.
Yeah.
I wrote it down in the calendar.
Yeah, like, I'm going to maximize my recovery.
I'm better than this.
Mr. Recovery. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. So it wasn't, man. It honestly, that was the best decision I ever made, was going to treatment and then going to sober living, just because there was so much structure that I needed. There was so much that I didn't know about myself. I had no idea what the recovery community looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Today, man, like, what's so crazy is, like, I tell my guys that I work with, dude, you can be anything you want. You know, you want to have a house, you want to have a car, you want kids that aren't yours. You know, you want to open a business, you want to, like, all that stuff you can have. You know, it's materialistic. You can easily achieve it, I promise you. But more than anything, if you want, is just like this overwhelming sense of peace and calm within yourself that mm-hmm. you feel good about the person you are today. You can sleep at night, like real sleep. You know, you don't feel like a piece of shit when you lay your head down at night, you know, and there's no better feeling than that. There's nothing that can replace that. And sometimes, like, it was hard for me to grasp when someone told me that I could have that, mm-hmm. you know, and it took a while. But I remember feeling that feeling, and I'm like, felt like nirvana. Like, I had arrived. Like, no matter what happens, man, I'm going to be okay, you know? Like,
when I have sponsees or guys I work with show up, you know, they would be up in arms about, you know, somebody trying to take away what they have. Because again, the way I work steps, I mean, I've literally had people call it microwave recovery, you know, in this program, like, just shit's weird. So when I ever met with people, I would be like, don't let them take away what you have. You know, if your step took this long because they're, you know, talking about however long it took them for their step, that's their process. It's all judgment. So don't let them steal what you have. But they would come back, and there would invariably be somebody that would say, like, you know, like, there's always somebody that I'll hear in a meeting, and they're talking about judging or hearing somebody that's spiritual and really free. And whenever I hear that in a meeting, I explain working through steps, having a list. You know, I explain how my father was shot and killed, you know, when I was a year old. So I only ever wanted to be a father. And so when I had a daughter, you know, one time I was sick, I couldn't sleep. You know, I was in and out of the bathtub, and finally I felt like I was going to sleep. And you know, I heard her crying, and I was like, she just started to wake up, and I had to feed her. She was like 3-4 months old. And I was like, I'm only going to sleep for 5 minutes. It ended up being an hour. And she was like ecstatic. I couldn't calm her down. And in that moment, like, I was like, this is not the kind of father I want to be. You know, I'm super sick. But I was sharing that with a sponsee one time, 2 or 3 years later, and I could barely tell that story. I could barely get it out to him. You know, we're going back and forth on a 4-step. I had already made amends for that. I was living amends. I was clean, excellent father, being the guy I was supposed to be. So I explain it like, that was one thing on that list on my 9-step. So for somebody that's sharing that, maybe they don't understand what it's like when there's nothing there and the only decision that I have is the one I'm going to make today. There's nothing on that paper anymore. You know, like you're talking about the freedom, the peace is the fact that anything that's going to go on any paperwork is a decision that I decide to make today. So yeah, I understand you don't understand that freedom.
Yeah.
And you're judging it and calling me over spiritual.
Yeah.
Well, it's because I'm free of all that today. So
I love
that you said that.
Yeah. I mean, people are entitled to, that's the beautiful thing about not just recovery, just being a human being.
Yeah.
You're entitled to feel and think and say whatever you like. It's like how I react when that comes up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And dude, I'm not perfect. Like, people will get under my skin still,
mm-hmm.
but I have a daily reprieve. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, dude, I, you know, cut somebody off, or I screamed at somebody, like, I generally feel bad about it, you know, right after I do it. I never had that feeling. I didn't give a shit, you know, I just didn't care,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have a conscience today, you know, to generally feel bad if I hurt someone.
Right.
Or I may, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's on a whole, for me, it's on a whole nother level, because I'd never experienced that, you know, maybe when I was younger, but like once I was 19 and I had picked up that first one and I loved the way it made me feel and it set me on this journey, I people's feelings were, you know, they didn't
just about me.
Just didn't give a shit, man. Right. Like, I can pretend like I could to get what I wanted. Mm-hmm. I can, you know, play the sympathy card, move things around, manipulate to make it seem like I cared. But the reality is, I didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, and today, like, if I harm someone or if I hurt someone's feelings, like, my sarcasm is so bad, you know, and I can hurt people's feelings, and I have to, like, be careful with that, mm-hmm. you know, because at the end of the day, man, like, we get into recovery so that we can be drug free and alcohol free, but also to be better human beings.
Be of service.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And how am I going to do that when I'm constantly still an asshole and a manipulator, or, you know, constantly being sarcastic and putting people down? And so that's, like, the best thing that recovery mm-hmm. has given me, is a conscience, you know.
I always ask everybody, you know, if you can think of something before we end it, is if there's something that you can think of, like a war story, whether it's just a really hilarious using or war story or something funny or something crazy as shit that you can think of.
Hmm.
There's, man, usually some funny stories.
Usually, there, man, like, I years and years of Xanax use, yeah, man, I can't remember.
You
but
shut it off.
But there is a story that someone else told me.
Okay.
I'm at my buddy's house. He had, like, a house party. I leave, like, you know, everything's fine. He calls me the next morning, frantic, like, dude, someone stole my bike, and I don't know what happened to it. Like, somebody must have, you know, here at the party. And I'm like, dude, that sucks. And,
like, bicycle or motorcycle?
Motorcycle.
Holy shit. So, yeah. Two different things here. Yeah. So I'm glad we clarified that.
Beautiful new motorcycle he just bought, man. Like, super fast, like some nine. I don't ride, man. But I was like, dude, that sucks. And I'm sitting there walking up to the front door to have a cigarette, because I know that my son's mom doesn't like me smoking in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I open up the door and I see this beautiful yellow bike sitting right in my yard, tipped over. And I was like, what color is it? He's like, yellow. And I was like, oh, someone must have brought it over here. It's sitting in my yard.
They dropped me off.
Dude, I destroyed that dude's bike. I don't even know how. I don't ride. I've rode a dirt bike before. I've never rode a motorcycle.
The fact that you didn't die from that.
Yes, man. And he's like, what do you mean? I was like, I don't know, bro. It's just sitting out in my yard. And he's like,
the keys are in my pocket.
The keys were still in the bike.
Oh, my God.
Tipped over. I, like, dropped it a couple times. I don't even know how I got it back up. I don't remember any of that night. My son's mom doesn't remember any about that night, you know.
Was she on the back of the fucking thing?
No. She didn't go to the party.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No, I don't remember anything. And that was just like one of those, like, moments when someone told me that story. Like, today I have a God of my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
When they told me that story, and it wasn't too long ago that I heard that story from him, because she didn't remember it either. I was like, dude, that's a God moment. Like, I should not have been here. I didn't know how to ride. I dropped the bike. Like, I'm blacked out and I'm leaving his house party. And keep in mind, his house is probably a good, you know, 30 minutes away from where I was.
The fuck did you even make it there?
I have no idea, man.
You're like a bird.
Yeah.
Like, fucking migrating. Just the magnetic brought you directly to your house.
Have no idea, man. But I'm thankful for it. You know?
Yeah. Well, man, as a addict and alcoholic, I'd love you, dude. I appreciate you coming on here.
It was thanks for having
really,
me.
Really great. I'm sure we'll do it again.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man.